Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, December 23rd, 2014. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll find out about the Bustin' Out Boutique with owner Hollis Kitchen. We'll get an update from Eagle Crest. In honor of Hanukkah, which ends tomorrow evening, we'll hear Jeff Kirsch perform his piece, How to Make the Perfect Hanukkah Latkes for 30 on a Blustery Southeast Alaska Evening. And we'll hear a preview of Thursday night's Mudrooms broadcast on KTOO. Those interviews, specials, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Over the weekend, a Lakota man was shot and killed in an altercation with police in Rapid City, South Dakota. Charles Michael Ray talked with residents of Lakota Homes, the neighborhood where the incident occurred.
On Saturday evening, just after 6 p.m., Rapid City police received a call to remove an unwanted subject from a home. Captain Dan Rood alleges the suspect, 30-year-old Alan Locke, a Lakota man, attacked Officer Anthony Myros with a knife. Rood says Myros fired multiple shots, killing Locke.
The officer is white. The suspect is Native American, but it's not a race deal. This is based on criminal behavior and has nothing to do with race. If the police officer is Native American and the suspect was white, the result would have been the same thing.
Rood says the police had a history with Locke. County and state law enforcement are now investigating the incident. In the Lakota Homes neighborhood, local residents are grappling with the tragedy. Melanie Stoneman says Locke's children were in the home where the shooting occurred.
If you have a heart, you're going to cry with this. You're going to feel with this. You're going to understand.
Stoneman, a Sichungu Lakota, is a Rapid City resident on hand for a prayer service in the street in front of the home at the scene of the incident.
As this Indian people, that's our son. That's how we could say, that's our son. And any mother would say that. Any mother's heart would hurt for another mother.
Stoneman says police are not dealing properly with deeper issues surrounding this tragedy. For her, this incident contributes to a longstanding mistrust of police in this community. Police officials say maintaining community trust is a top priority, and they will continue efforts to improve race relations. For National Native News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Native leaders say one of the biggest lingering problems in Indian country is lack of good infrastructure. Matt Laszlo has more.
Tribal leaders are trying to get the U.S. government's help to restore crumbling infrastructure like roads and water pipes. When tribal leaders recently came to Washington, they raised the problems with administration officials. Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox touts a Transportation Department Ladder of Opportunity initiative that he says helped a couple of tribal communities afford bus service.
But having said that, when I talk about the infrastructure deficit around the country, there's no place that feels that more than Indian country.
Garth Sundberg chairs the Tribal Council of the Sherry Heights Indian Community of the Trinidad Rancheria, which is in Northern California. Sundberg says getting federal infrastructure grants is a waiting game, even after he expends money and time to get funding moving.
Well, first of all, you got to have a master plan of doing things. Then you got to, whether it comes out in a grant or whatever, then you got to get your grant writer to write a grant, and then you got to go with 100 other people trying to get the same grant, so it's just competitive.
Pete Polite is treasurer of the Alabama Coushatta Tribe of Texas. He laments development projects caught up in environmental and historical red tape, even on land just outside his reservation.
Sometimes you can find artifacts, but, unfortunately, you find them by discovery and all that. Like, if there was to be a construction that was to take place in a certain area, first it'll have to be an environmental check of that area first.
A congressional fight on how to fund U.S. highways will come to a head by May, at which point the White House might have to make a final push for its Grow America Act. Cabinet members tell tribal leaders that the legislation would increase funding for the tribal transportation program. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, December 23rd, 2014. I'm your host, Scott Burton. And now, in from the Bustin' Out Boutique is Lindsay Burnett. Welcome, Lindsay.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you in the studio today. So you are one of the partners that runs the Bustin' Out Boutique. Tell our listeners about your shop.
Well, we are currently selling lingerie and maternity wear. The lingerie, more consistently, is going to be bras and panties for women. And eventually, we'll also be selling maternity bras and panties. And then we also have maternity clothing, so pants, tops, and nursing clothing for moms who are nursing their children.
Okay. And so this was it's a collaboration between you and Hollis, it sounds like. When did the idea for this store come up, and how did it evolve?
So about 2 years ago, while Hollis was taking a business course at the university, she came up with this idea, and she's kind of been working on moving towards this the last few years. And then a friend of mine was telling me how she was looking for some maternity clothes and couldn't find anything. She was really bummed out about it. And I came to Hollis and said, well, how about we put these two ideas together and see what we can make of it. And that was early September, late September, somewhere in there. And so about 2 months later, here we are.
And how's it going?
It's going really well so far. We've had an excellent reception from the community, and people are really excited about our free bra fittings and having that stuff available for them.
Okay. You were saying that there's some stuff that folks may not know about fittings and proper attire. Could you tell us more about that?
Of course. So, fun fact, somewhere between 70 to 80% of women are wearing the wrong size bra. There are a couple of ways that you can really tell that you're wearing the wrong size bra if you just take a minute to look at it. If the band is riding up your back, then your band size is too big. There's a piece between the two cups called the gore, and if that's not actually sitting on your sternum, if that's sitting on your breast tissue, then that tends to mean that you have the wrong cup size. The most important thing to know about the band is that that's actually 80% of the support that you get from your bra. And then you should get 20% from your strap, so 10 per strap. And that's one reason why a lot of women don't realize that they're wearing the wrong size, is because they think that it's supposed to fit like that.
Okay. And you were saying the wrong size bra can lead to back pain and all kinds of other things, right?
A lot of back pain. A good example is actually Hollis, my business partner. And she had back pain for years. She was fitted into something like a 38 double D, because that is unfortunately where a lot of American stores stop at, is a 38 double D, maybe a triple D if you're lucky. And so she would ask her boyfriend for a back rub pretty much every night. She went on a trip to Germany. Yeah, nice guy, very nice guy. She went on a trip to Germany, and she got fitted correctly and was able to find bras that fit her, and she no longer had back pain. She realized after about a month that she hadn't asked for a back rub and that everything was where it was supposed to be and things felt really good. So,
interesting. And earlier you mentioned that you do free fittings. How does that work for someone when they come in?
So what we do is we take three measurements, and you just have to come in and say that you would like to be fitted. So those three measurements are really simple. It's the under bust, so the band size. And then there's one where you're standing. We go over the widest part of your chest, at your breast and your chest. And then we do one more just to make sure we get a really good volume measurement. And that's just have you lean forward a little bit, and you go ahead and we'll wrap that around you too.
So. Okay. And you're located in the Senate building.
Mm-hmm.
on the second floor.
Yes, we are.
Right, downtown. And what are your hours going into the holidays here?
Into the holidays, we've been open from 11 to 5, 5:30. Tomorrow, we are going to be open a little bit earlier and a little bit later since it is Christmas Eve. So we'll be open from 10:30 to probably 6.
Okay, tomorrow?
Yeah. Yes, and then we'll be closed Christmas Day, obviously.
Sure, sure. What have been some of your most popular items so far?
Bras that fit.
Yeah.
So we started off with a fairly small stock because we didn't know what going into it what a lot of the sizes are in Juno, because a lot of women are measured wrong. So we've had women coming in saying they're a 36B, and we've put them in a 30 double D, triple D, because that's actually what fits their rib cage and their cup size. And so really the biggest seller, besides gift certificates, which we do have, has been just bras that fit. And women walk out comfortable and confident and really happy with feeling like things are where they're supposed to be.
Okay. And does somebody need to call if they do want to do a fitting? Do they need to call first or just come on in?
Absolutely not. They can just come on in. If they would like to do a private fitting so they can have a little bit more of that privacy, we can close the door for them and put a note on the door saying we're doing a private fitting. But otherwise, just come on in, and we can make time for you, and we'll get it done. It usually only takes about 5 minutes. It's really not a very long process.
All right, Lindsay, are we missing anything?
Not that I can think of. You know, do we have great bras? We have great styles. We're getting more in all the time. We have some really nice maternity wear. One thing about the maternity wear that I forgot to mention earlier is in about a year, we would like to be able to do consignment for our maternity wear. So moms who, you know, kind of are shy about buying things for themselves while they're pregnant or while they're nursing have an opportunity to bring it back. And then after that, they can use that money to get a post-baby bra, something along those lines. So and keep it good for them and happy.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in today, Lindsay.
Thanks, Scott.
It's about 15 minutes after 3 o'clock, and you're listening to a Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, December 23rd, 2014. Scott Burton, your host here. I'm going to play a piece for you here that was recorded during our holiday edition of Writer's Showcase.
Our first writer is Jeff Kirsch. In his piece about latkes, he not only teaches us about how to make the traditional Jewish pancake, but he also explores how traditions evolve and how to do the best with what you have. Here's Jeff Kirsch reading, How to Make the Perfect Hanukkah Latke for 30 on a Blustery Southeast Alaska Evening.
I just want to preface that I do recognize the incongruity of wearing a Santa hat but reading a piece about Hanukkah. But I'm really bald, and a yarmulke just wasn't going to be big enough. We are filming, so. Because making the perfect Hanukkah latke, or potato pancake, is kind of a pain, your usual first step is just going out and buying instant latke mix. But you live in Alaska now, not New York City. You can't find instant latke mix for 1,000 miles in any direction. So not only will you make latkes the hard way, you're making them for 30, because Juneau's a small town, and once you ask one person to dinner, you're compelled to invite everyone else you know, lest they find out later and feel slighted. Also, there's something satisfying about feeding a crowd, particularly with a dish more quintessentially Jewish than Chinese food on Christmas, which you will also be making the hard way, because in Alaska, even the Chinese restaurants close that day. But that's a different recipe. Today, it's latkes. Upping the difficulty, two young children, who insist upon helping mostly by attacking each other with kitchen implements. But you've cooked with them before. You are ready for their help. Anything to foster enthusiasm for their heritage. Plus, latkes are essentially deep-fried hash browns, and when else would you get to eat deep-fried hash browns for dinner, especially on a weeknight? To begin, you need potatoes. Your recipe, a variation of your grandmother's, calls for 5 large russets. You'll be using Yukon Gold, partly in homage to the Great Northwest, but also no peeling. Remember what happened when your kid sous chefed last year's perfect Thanksgiving mashed potatoes? No need to relive that debacle. Grandmom's recipe yields 25 recipes. You will quadruple, then have it, one portion for each child. Warning, do the math in advance. Your version also calls for several bottles of beer. Not for the latkes, but for you. Numbers can get tricky later. Speaking of which, defrost a hunk of salmon in case of epic failure. Be thankful that you live in Alaska, where a 10-minute replacement meal can be grilled wild sockeye with maple butter glaze. Lower 48, it'd be freezer burn Trader Joe's turkey meatballs or something. Grate potatoes and onions in a 5-to-1 ratio, in this case, 20-to-4. Unless you've recently stocked up on Banzai's at Costco, do not hand grate. Just break out the Cuisinart you got as a wedding gift and use only once a year. Let this be that once. While food processing explicitly define which child hits the button and which child pushes the plunger, alternating if necessary to keep the peace. This is possibly the most important step, aside from establishing 2 separate, identical, non-breakable workstations. Failure to follow these steps might still yield perfect latkes, but will likely turn a pleasant holiday activity into a 3-way intergenerational meltdown. And who needs that kind of permanent emotional scarring on Hanukkah? Speaking of which, go ahead and open that beer. Turn on some music. Not Hanukkah music, not even kids' music, but music you actually like. Something cheerful like the Beatles or Bob Marley, whatever puts you in a good mood. No Radiohead. Next, place shredded potato onion mixture into 2 kitchen towels, 1 per child. Wring out excess liquid, loosen, and wring again, this time by yourself. Seriously, the more moisture you squeeze out, the crispier the latkes, which requires adult hand strength, even little girly man hands like yours. Create a diversion by breaking out cheese sticks. Need more time? Open a package of dried seaweed. Personally, you can't stand the stuff, but your kids claim eating it makes them feel like dinosaurs, and you can't argue with that. Even though it smells like dead fish and crumbles into a zillion shards that turn to dust when you try to pick them up. At this point, your wife will text, forcing you to touch your phone with sticky, starchy, oniony, seaweed-encrusted fingers. She's adding another family, sideways, smiley face. That's cool. You've anticipated this. You're making 100 latkes, and 100 latkes is a whole lot of latkes. Although, you will run out of applesauce. You always run out of applesauce. But fear not. Latkes also go well with ketchup, mustard, honey mustard, ranch, maple syrup, sriracha mayo, any dip really, they're excellent calorie shovels. Set aside potato onion mixture and ask if anyone needs to go potty. After pee break, hopefully just pee, but with well-supervised hand washing either way, into each mixing bowl crack 6 eggs, 12 total, 3 from the original, quadrupled, but again, split equally between 2 children. You understand why you do the math beforehand? Purell on standby. Combine eggs with 4 heaping tablespoons baking powder and ideally 2 cups of matzo meal, but good luck finding that locally. Most likely you'll have to crush up saltines with your wood stove hatchet. Open second beer. Stir in salt and pepper to taste. Grandmom had high blood pressure. The seasonings are way off in all her recipes. She also experienced chronic acid reflux. Go ahead and add chopped garlic, too. Blend potato mixture with egg mixture, stirring until coated. Batter should be moist, but not soupy. If needed, thicken with more potato or substitute shredded carrots. Why not sneak in legit veggies? Sure, you're also serving salad, but your kids won't eat salad. Oh, they'll ask for it. They'll even compel you to fetch extra dressings, feta, and craisins, but they won't eat it. Salad in front of other kids? Never. Preheat oven to 325. Reach into the chaos of pots, pans, crockery, and Tupperware you call your cabinet until you find 2 large dishes, one of which won't melt in the oven. Put that one in the oven. Line the other with paper towel. Don't put that one in the oven. With children manning the timer at a safe remove, in 2 skillets heat 1/8 inch vegetable oil. Traditionally, you'd fry latkes in rendered chicken fat, also known as schmaltz. But that's a mail order item to be sure, and you're not about to overnight a brick of schmaltz from Brooklyn. Plus, half your friends are vegetarian anyway. While the oil heats, tell your kids about Hanukkah and how the holiday celebrates a small band of ancient Hebrews who, after defeating the Syrian Greek army and liberating Jerusalem, rededicated the Holy Temple, of which the Western Wall still stands, by lighting 1 day's worth of oil that miraculously lasted 8, until more could arrive from neighboring traders. Tell them that this explains the ceremonial 8-candled Hanukkah menorah and the customary eating of fried foods. It's also the first documented warning about over-reliance on foreign oil. Open third beer. Working in batches, drop spoonfuls of batter into hot oil, flattening with spatula. Cook until golden brown, approximately 3 minutes on each side. By this point, Mom should be home from work. She and the guests will handle cleanup. That's the unspoken social contract. Transfer latkes to paper towel-lined dish to drain, and then into oven while frying the remainder. Change your clothes and shower when finished, as you will reek like a KFC dumpster. Later, after the kids go to sleep, this will make it tough to cash in with your wife for facilitating such a tasty, impromptu Hanukkah party. Serve latkes warm with applesauce, sour cream, or whatever your favorite condiment. Nacho cheese? Deservedly self-content for overcoming your usual laziness. Realistically, nothing competes with American Christmas, not even the Super Bowl. But tonight, you've created a meaningful cultural experience for your family and friends while simultaneously making your kids feel just a little bit less bad about not having a Christmas tree. Also, you gave them new bikes, and that's going to help a lot, too. Thank you.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon on December 23rd, 2014. Scott Burton, your host, and with me now via telephone is Jeffra Clow. Hi, Jeffra.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me on the show this afternoon.
You're welcome. Thanks for being on the phone. Are you calling from the mountain right now?
I am calling from the mountain, and it's been a great day up on the mountain today.
Well, good.
Yeah.
What else is going on up there?
So, well, we have our annual Christmas Eve celebration tomorrow, Christmas Eve, and we have just a great late afternoon and early evening events planned. So everything kicks off tomorrow afternoon about 3:15, where we're going to have live music by Heartstrings. 3:30, we're going to let the kids make their own Christmas ornament, and you can either stick it up on our Christmas tree, or you can take it home and put it on your own Christmas tree. We're going to have some cider and cookies. We're working with Beth at the Juneau Public Library, and she's going to come in and read 'Twas the Night Before Christmas at 4:30 tomorrow afternoon. 5 o'clock, we're going to gather all the kids at the bottom of the porcupine chair and take a ride up the porcupine chair and do a torchlight parade and light the way for Santa's sleigh. And at 5:30, Scott, I'm really hoping Santa can land his sleigh at the top of the porcupine chair and come down and visit all of us here at Eagle Crest.
That sounds like a lot of fun, and that all starts at 3:15 tomorrow, huh?
3:15 tomorrow, and you can find out the entire schedule of events on our website at skijuneau.com.
All right. And, Jeffrey, I'm looking at the forecast right now, and I see snow and rain likely coming towards Christmas Day. What are you thinking?
Well, you know, we have all asked Santa Claus for snow for Christmas,
mm-hmm.
and we're watching the forecast. I saw the snowmakers headed up to the top of Porcupine again, so with this little bit cooler weather, we're going to make some more snow, but we're doing our snow dances and kind of watching the weather. Hopefully it's looking like they'll give us some more snow, and we really want to get some more terrain open, but unfortunately until we get a big dump of snow, we are not going to be able to do that. But right now we've got the Porcupine Chair open, and we're all having a great time.
And you're open every day but Christmas, is that right?
Yep, we are closed on Christmas Day, so we're going to let our family and or all our employees spend Christmas Day with their family and their friends. And from all of us up at Eagle Crest, we would like to wish everyone at K2 and in K2's listening land a very Merry Christmas.
Well, thank you very much for calling in today, Jeffra, and have a great day tomorrow.
All right. Thank you, Scott, and enjoy the rest of the day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Join KXLL for live music New Year's Eve at the Hangar on the Wharf for the 4th annual Block Party. Deering and Down in the Hangar Ballroom. And DJs Astronomar and Shorthand in the Hangar. Balloon drop at midnight by Night Moods, and if you get hungry, there's pizza by the slice from Pizzeria Roma. The party starts at 9 o'clock.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 23rd of December, 2013. 1947, on this day, the first transistor was demonstrated at Bell Laboratories in New Jersey by its inventors, William Shockley, Walter Brattain, and John Bardeen, replacing the vacuum tubes, which were big and awkward and used a lot of electricity and put off too much heat and did not work very well. The new transistor was invented to amplify current, and for it, the three inventors received the Nobel Prize in 1956. The first transistor, about half an inch high, today 7 million of them can fit on a single silicon chip. It's the birthday of Robert Bly, the poet, Madison, Minnesota, 1926, grew up on the prairies, western Minnesota, went to Harvard. He was there when Donald Hall and John Ashbery and Frank O'Hara were there. After college, decided he'd spend a year living alone and writing. The 1 year stretched into four. He lived in a cabin in northern Minnesota. He moved to New York City, supported himself by painting. Went off to Iowa City, taught there for a time, and then moved to a farm just down the road from where he had grown up. And the poems he wrote there became his first book, Silence in the Snowy Fields. It's the birthday of the woman who founded Poetry Magazine, Harriet Monroe, Chicago, 1860. She and her magazine were the first to publish Carl Sandburg and Rupert Brooke, Robert Frost, D.H. Lawrence, William Carlos Williams. She continued to edit Poetry Magazine until she died, 1936, 75 years old, in Peru on her way to climb Machu Picchu. And it's the birthday of the novelist Donna Tartt, Greenwood, Mississippi, 1963, whose third novel, The Goldfinch, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction this year, which begins, "While I was still in Amsterdam, I dreamed about my mother for the first time in years. I'd been shut up in my hotel for more than a week. It was Christmas, lights twinkling on the canal bridges at night, people clattering down the cobblestones with Christmas trees lashed to the backs of their bicycles." Here's a poem by Robert Bly on his birthday, "Three Kinds of Pleasures." 1. Sometimes riding in a car in Wisconsin or Illinois, you notice those dark telephone poles one by one lift themselves out of the fence line and slowly leap on the gray sky and past them, the snowy fields. 2. The darkness drifts down like snow on the picked cornfields in Wisconsin, and on these black trees scattered one by one through the winter fields, we see stiff weeds and brownish stubble and white snow left now only in the wheel tracks of the combine. 3. It is a pleasure also to be driving toward Chicago near dark and see the lights in the barns, the bare trees more dignified than ever, like a fierce man on his deathbed, and the ditches along the road half full of a private snow. 3 Kinds of Pleasures by Robert Bly from Silence in the Snowy Fields, published by Wesleyan University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Tonight on 360 North, watch the BBC World News at 7 and Alaska Weather at 7:30. At 8 o'clock, enjoy Dylan Thomas' classic memory, A Child's Christmas in Wales. Native Report is next at 8:30. At 9, see how a well-crafted story can encourage and inspire the bereaved. In Juno storyteller Tom Cosgrove's Healing Through Stories, China's Challenges follows at 10. We wish you a safe and happy holiday season from 360 North.
It's about 38 minutes after 3. You're listening to a Juno Afternoon. In the coming days, we have several Christmas specials, holiday specials, a Kwanzaa special coming up. I'll tell you about all of those later. Among them is the Mudrooms broadcast from their December 14th recording, their event, storytelling. And so here's a preview. This will play on Thursday night at 7, the entire one-hour program. And here is Paul DeSlover.
Our next speaker is Paul DeSlover. Paul was born in 1948 on a bitterly cold January morning in Monroe, Michigan, and from birth longed for a big brother. 10 minutes later, his prayers were answered when his twin, Dale, exited the womb 2.5 pounds heavier. From that moment on, that's a lot. Big difference. From that moment on, Paul occasionally regretted that neonatal wish as he languished in the shadow of a twin who was always bigger, smarter, better looking, and more athletic. However, when it came to harebrained ideas, Dale could not hold a candle to his older brother, Paul. And Paul has a special guest. I think our youngest audience member tonight is five-week-old Nora, his granddaughter. She's in the back. She's really cute. Please help me welcome Paul.
Okay, my story tonight is about how I accidentally came to live in Juneau, Alaska. It was April 1974, and I was sitting in a bar with my younger brother Steve and a friend Kevin. And after a couple drinks, we decided that we were going to buy road bikes and ride our bikes from Monroe, Michigan to Fairbanks, Alaska. So a couple of weeks later, we went into the Bob's bike store and told him of our intentions, and he said, "I'll tell you what, boys," he said, "I'll give you a 15% discount on your bikes and all your equipment if you'll let me contact the Monroe newspaper and have them do a story on your trip." And without thinking of the ramifications, we said, "Sure." So he said, "Well, the bikes you want are going to take a couple weeks to get here, but I'll give you a call." So we went back home, and at the end of April, we got a call from Bob, and we thought, "Good, our bikes are in." And he said, "Well, the bikes aren't in, but the newspaper reporter wants to meet with you guys and get some background and find out what your plans are." So we said, "Okay." So we met with the reporter for about an hour and a half. And about a week later, we get another call from Bob in May. He says, "Hey, your bikes are in." So we went down, we picked up our bikes. And we were a little concerned that we hadn't had any training, but we figured our youth and our exuberance might get us through. And we were planning to leave town on June 1st. So we didn't have much time to train. In fact, we only rode maybe 2 or 3 rides of 10, 15 miles is all. And so June 1st came, and we were all packed up for the first time, our gear on our bikes for the very first time, and we were surrounded by friends and family and the newspaper reporter and now a newspaper photographer. And to all kinds of fanfare, we mount our bikes, our Fuji S10s, and head out of town, heading north into a strong wind in the first leg of our 4,200-mile trip. We intended on riding for about 3 hours. We figured we'd be about 45 miles down the road at this nice little campsite. And as it turned out, because of the strong wind and our lack of preparation, It took us almost 6 hours to get to the campsite. And when we got there, we got off the bikes, and Kevin said, "Man, what were we thinking?" And I said, "I don't know what I was thinking, but I'm thinking now we better come up with some other options." And my brother brought us back to reality. He says, "Hey, boys, in 2 hours, every house in Monroe is going to have a newspaper on their doorstep heralding our trip to Alaska." He said, "You know what that means?" And with a big grin, he said, "We can't go home." And Kevin, we pause for a minute, and Kevin says, "Man, we are royally screwed." So that was the beginning of our trip. We unpacked our gear, put up our tents, crawled inside, and we're so disillusioned, I don't even think we ate that night. In the morning, we woke up, realized it wasn't a bad dream, and we were, in fact, in a hell of our own making. So we got on our bikes eventually. We went 15 miles that day. The winds were even worse. And we found a nice little roadside park, stopped, set up our tents, and we're wondering what is going to happen. The next day, we felt a little better. The winds were a little less harsh, and we actually did about 50 miles. Within about 6 days, we had got about 200 miles into central Michigan, into a town. We started here in southeastern Michigan. So now we were here. So we decided to stop into a little five and dime store in Harrison, Michigan, to see if they had any foam pillows that we could put on our seats, because our arses weren't cooperating with our seats on our bikes. And they did have some, so we got that and some electrical tape, and we wrapped them all around our seat. And the next morning, it was a whole lot nicer getting on that bike. And so we took off, and we started doing a little better after that. And so we went up to the middle of lower Michigan, went over the Mackinac Bridge, the bridge that connects the two, upper and lower Michigan, went up to Sault Ste. Marie, and turned west and headed across the state on Route 2. We had a lot of adventures during this trip. And one of those was including stopping for 8 days to paint a dairy barn for a widow and her daughter. So anyway, we continued across. We got all the way across Michigan into Wisconsin, and we're heading across from across Wisconsin. And we had all kinds of adventures during that period, but we were meandering a lot. So we weren't making the time we had hoped to make. We had planned to be in Fairbanks by mid-August. And So we go all across Wisconsin, then we go across Minnesota, and the whole time the wind's in our face. There wasn't a day where there wasn't wind in our face. But unbelievably, we were getting stronger and more capable of riding, so we were doing pretty well. We were averaging about 65 to 75 miles a day by then. And we stopped in this little town called Rugby, North Dakota, claimed to fame as the geographical center of North America. And we went into the geographical center cafe, and we were, of course, skinny, bearded, long hair, wearing cut-off blue jeans and tank tops, and the waitress said, what would you boys like? And I said, "Well, I'd like a cheeseburger and fries," and ditto for my companions. And we finished that, and she said, "Well, can I get you any dessert?" And I said, "Well, I'd like another cheeseburger and fries," and I ditto for my companions. And we got done with that, and she said, "Well, I'm sure you don't want any dessert, boys." And I said, "Well, I don't know. The menu said you had fresh apple pie. Is it fresh apple pie?" She says, "Oh, yeah, we bake them here every day." And I said, "Do you have more than one?" And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "Though, so can I buy one?" And then she got real skeptical, and she said, "Listen, are you guys planning to pay for this?" And we said, yeah, we'll pay for it. So turns out all three of us got a whole apple pie. And then we got out on our bikes and we rode for 80 miles. That day, we did 125 miles. But as we were leaving the restaurant, the waitress came over to us and she said, "By the way, boys, what planet are you guys from?" And so we got on our bikes and we rode off. So we get across North Dakota, we go up into Minot, And we went from Minot to a place called Portal on the Saskatchewan border. We go up, we head north up Saskatchewan to Highway 1 in Canada, get on Highway 1 in Canada, and cross the plains into Calgary, or not into Calgary, into Alberta, and cross Alberta into Banff, up the Bow Pass really slow, down the Bow Pass really fast. We were fast passing every car on the road, and the speed limit was 40 miles an hour. Up the Sunwapta Pass really slow, down the Sunwapta Pass really fast, and into Jasper. From Jasper, we continued on to St. George, and we were all excited because we were going to, after leaving St. George, we were going to be on the Alcan. And so that morning we left St. George. We only got about a mile, and we were stopped by the RCMP, had the road blocked, and they were stopping everybody. And he came up to us and said, "Where are you boys going?" We said, "Well, we're riding our bikes to Fairbanks, Alaska." And he said, "Not on this road, you ain't." We're thinking, "What? Are we breaking the law? What's going on?" And he said, "The road's been totally washed out, and it's going to be, you know, a couple weeks before it's passable, and probably for longer for a bike." And we said, "Well, boy, what do we do? We're going to Fairbanks." He said, "Well, go to ride your bikes to Prince Rupert, get on a ferry there, an Alaska ferry, get a ticket to Haines, get off on Haines, go up the Haines Highway, and you can connect with the Alaskan Highway again." We'd never heard of Southeast Alaska. We didn't even know it existed. So we were so far behind on our schedule, because this was July 31st, that we decided to board a train in St. George, and we got on a train and rode the train all the way to Prince Rupert, or Prince George, and rode all the way to Prince Rupert, and got there just in time to catch the morning ferry leaving. So we're on the ferry, we go, you know, to Ketchikan, it's raining. We go to Wrangell, it's raining. We go to Petersburg, it's raining. We're coming into Juneau in the morning, and we're coming up the channel, and it was gorgeous. The sun's rising over the mountains. It was like paradise, and we're all mesmerized. And so we said, "You know what? Let's get off here for a couple hours," because you could. And so we got off, and after about an hour, we said, "You know what? Let's go get our bikes and get off here for a few days." Because in those days, you could get a ticket from A to D, and you could get off in B and C as long as you wanted. So we went back on the ferry, got our bikes off, and after 4 or 5 days of sunshine, we were totally hooked on Juneau. So we decided to stay, and so we went over to the federal building where they knew they had a payphone, and decided to call our families and let them know what was up, because we had very little contact with our families till then. The only time we contacted them was we'd call, make a call, and we'd say, and one of my parents would answer, I'd like to make a collect call, operator. She goes, "Okay, give me the number, 241-2534, and who's calling?" "Paul." She would connect the call, and they'd say, "We have a collect call from Paul. Will you accept the charges?" And they would say, "No." And the operator would say, "I'm sorry, Paul, he won't accept the charges." And I'd say, "Well, it's Paul from Minot, Minnesota, or Minot, North Dakota." And they would go, "Sorry, still won't accept the charges." So we were that's how we let them know where we were and that we were safe. So anyway, but I digress. So we go into the federal building, we get on the payphone, and I called home and got my mom on the phone. And I said, "Hey, guess what? We decided to stay in Juneau, Alaska for a while. It's a beautiful place here." And she said, "Well, aren't you going to go on to Fairbanks?" And we said, "Probably not. I think we're just going to stay here, at least for some amount of time." And I said, "But I kind of feel bad because they did that story on us in the Minot Evening News." And she said, "Well, you know what?" And I said, "What?" She said, "They never ran the story." And I said, "What?" She says, "No." She said, "They ran a story at the same time about three other boys from Monroe who were riding their bikes from Monroe to California and back." I said, "I'll be darned." I got off the phone, and my brother and Kevin said, "What was that all about?" I said, "Monroe Evening News never ran the story on our bike trip to Fairbanks." And we looked at each other and almost simultaneously said, "We could have gone home." And that's it.
support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, providing services for identification, evaluation, and rehabilitation for individuals with hearing difficulties. Located in the Jordan Creek Center. Information at 789-6780.
It's about 8 till 4, and you're listening to a Juno Afternoon. On January 8th, Juno Jazz and Classics is presenting the House Jacks, a cappella at its finest. Here's a sample of that.
I confess my faults, but I won't take the guilt. I will wipe my hand right through this house of cards you're trying to build me. If you really want me to, I will pack my things and go. You don't want me to. You profess your love, but you give me no quarter. You call to say you're coming home. I hear you making tracks across the border. If you really want me to, I will let you slip away. Come on. You don't want me to. And if the skies been open, the ground might shake. There ain't no fear can make me forsake you. I know all your troubles, and I tell you, baby, I'll still take you. Now listen, you can fall in love, but you climb into love. You can drench the earth with holy water, but you work the soil with a pick and shovel. If you really want me to, I will let the fields go dry. Come on, you don't want me to.
That was a selection from the House Jacks, who will be here on the 8th of January, playing at 7:30 at the Jack. You can get tickets at jazzandclassics.org or at the Jack. Hearthside Books, or call 463-3378. Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon today. Tomorrow on a Juno Afternoon is Jonathan Winter's Christmas Carol. And he's used as a special performing edition prepared by Dickens for his own presentations. He recreates Ebenezer Scrooge, Bob Cratchit, Tiny Tim, Jacob Marley's spirit, and the three Christmas ghosts, past, present, and future. So on Thursday, during a Juno Afternoon, Tinsel Tales 3, NPR Christmas Stories. Lynn Neary hosts a collection of extraordinary Christmas stories that will transport you to unexpected places. Adi Cornish, Ken Harbaugh, Nina Totenberg, and other voices from NPR's past and present tell stories of the season in that hour-long special on Thursday. And on Friday, A Season's Griot 2014. This one-hour celebration in story and song is public radio's only nationally syndicated Kwanzaa program. So tune in to that on Friday from 3 to 4 right here on KTOO News. Let's see, as for the weather tonight, decreasing clouds, colder, lows 20 to 31. Tomorrow, increasing clouds, highs around 31. And tomorrow night, Wednesday night, snow developing, lows 25 to 30. Christmas Day, snow and rain likely, highs around 34. And Thursday night through Friday night, rain and snow likely, highs around 31.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juno, KTOO is on GCI Cable, on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And stay tuned for All Things Considered.